Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We're checking in on Hollywood. We've got lots of current events. And Bess Levin must have taken a summer vacation, but she is back. So we are going to reserve some time at the end to see what she has to talk about this week. We are going to start with current events. This first headline is Inside the Fiery Backlash Against Paramount's Late Show Cancellation. The furor we've seen on Late Night and South Park is just the beginning. TV writers plan to make the cultural cost of capitulating to Trump as high as possible. This is by Laura Bradley on July 29th. The timing sure seems to speak for itself. On the July 14th episode of his late-night talk show, Stephen Colbert condemned Paramount for settling what First Amendment advocates have called a frivolous lawsuit from Donald Trump, while the Federal Communications Commission just happened to be deliberating Paramount's upcoming merger with Skydance. Specifically, Colbert called the move a big, fat bribe. A day later, Skydance CEO David Ellison met with FCC leaders as the company's proposed merger with Paramount hung in the balance. 2 days after that, Paramount announced that Colbert's Late Show would end next May at the close of the broadcast season. On Thursday, the FCC approved the merger. Paramount has framed the cancellation as purely a financial decision, and anonymous sources have told multiple news outlets that the show was losing at least $40 million per year. But for some reason, journalists, TV writers, and politicians don't seem to be buying it. The backlash has been swift and relentless, including on Paramount-owned platforms. The president does not get to pick what goes on TV, and I think a lot of people, regardless of political affiliation, would generally agree with that statement, says Liz Hines, a late-night writer and Writers Guild of America East council member whose past credits include The Late Show and Last Week Tonight with John Oliver. Colbert, who will remain on air for about 10 more months, has said the gloves are off. On the also Paramount-owned Daily Show, Colbert's former boss, Jon Stewart, told the corporate overlords, "Go fuck yourself." Predictably, South Park's season 27 premiere found a particularly colorful and phallic way to knock both Trump and its owners. None of these comic voices were exactly soft on Trump before, or ever reluctant to bite the hand that feeds them, but now it seems they're more revved up than ever, and they're not alone. Some are calling on viewers to cancel their Paramount Plus subscriptions in retaliation. A petition to save The Late Show, delivered to Paramount headquarters, reportedly garnered more than 250,000 signatures. Last Monday, a crowd of protesters gathered at Ed Sullivan Theater, where The Late Show films. And in a poetic bit of irony, Colbert's YouTube viewership is soaring. Prominent comedians, actors, and writers, including David Letterman, Michael Schur, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Jamie Lee Curtis, and Andy Richter, have criticized the decision. The comedy community hopes to make the cultural cost of capitulating to Trump as high as possible. "We are a fighting union," says another late-night insider who requested anonymity for fear of becoming a target of the administration, comparing the pro-Colbert fervor to the passion that animated the 2023 writers' strike. "We fought in the strike and won. We will keep fighting because it's not just for us." It's hard to overstate how devastating The Late Show's cancellation feels, not just for the late-night genre, but for the entertainment industry as a whole. The Late Show reportedly employs roughly 200 people, and from a labor perspective, Hines says, this is going to leave a real crater. For the past 3 decades, Hines notes, late-night talk shows have also launched the careers of talent like Oscar and Emmy winner Cord Jefferson and The Menu co-writer Seth Reiss. It's an important promotional vehicle for emerging musicians, actors, television series, and feature films as well. Although podcasts and YouTube series like Hot Ones and Chicken Shop Date serve a similar function in the current publicity landscape, they tend to book A-listers over new talent. Even the established celebrities who appear on those shows will want to sit across from late-night hosts like Colbert. It's important for actors, musicians, and artists at every single point in their career to be able to connect with new fans and get their art out there, Hines says. And Late Show was really, I think, a more democratic way for people to do that. In the face of declining linear ratings, fatalistic questions about late night's future have become common enough that Paramount cited the medium's challenging backdrop in its statement about the Late Show's cancellation. But even as the industry faces significant headwinds, writers question the assertion that late night talk shows are a dying breed. If you went to any network and said, "I can guarantee you 2.5 million people a night, 260 nights a year," they would jump at that, the Late Night Insider says. In this writer's view, the inability to monetize these programs isn't a flaw in the genre or any individual show. It's that the studios don't even do things like put the show up at the same time on the app. You can't watch Colbert on Paramount Plus. You have to watch it the next day when it's old. For multiple reasons, both writers are also skeptical about the $40 million Colbert show is allegedly losing each year. According to Hines, traditionally, networks don't even measure a late-night show's success by its profitability. In shareholder reports and awards campaigns, they'll instead tout the show's ratings. In that respect, Colbert is still and has been the category leader. For a corporation as big as Paramount, $40 million also sounds like a drop in the bucket. Where else has CBS spent $40 million they didn't need to spend, Hines said. What kind of negotiation is just handing down a sentence to a show without giving them an opportunity to trim costs? Both writers also question the figure itself, which has been printed and reprinted with no official confirmation or documentation. As Hines points out, this wouldn't be the first time a studio has fudged numbers to suit its needs, if, in fact, that is what's happening here. When reached for comment, CBS directed Vanity Fair back to the statement the network released when announcing the Late Show's cancellation. The writers note that Paramount's decision comes 2 years after their union's last strike. During negotiations, the WGA shot down a proposal from Hollywood studios that essentially would have turned late-night writing into gig work, shrinking writers' 13-week minimum contracts into day-long contracts. My most pessimistic read on a situation like that is that CEOs who resent having to deal with unions are always looking for reasons to get rid of those spaces, Hines says. It adds insult to injury in that I think it's also pre-capitulating to a fascist, but I do think that there are some people in this industry that want to just blow up union-dense spaces wherever possible. And as tempting as it might be to assume Late Show's creative team and crew will simply find a new home on streaming, that logic assumes other platforms aren't subject to the same challenges as CBS. All of those streamers are also susceptible to pressure from Trump, the Late Night Insider says, noting Ted Sarandos and David Zaslav's apparent attempts at a friendlier relationship with Trump. There's not a place you can go. Trump has done more than his fair share of whining about Colbert, including publicly calling for him to be replaced. The Writers Guild of America has expressed concerns that Paramount canceled The Late Show as a bribe and called on New York State Attorney General Letitia James to investigate the sequence of events. Politicians including Elizabeth Warren, Adam Schiff, Pramila Jayapal, and Bernie Sanders have cast aspersions on the decision as well. "Everybody's out there saying it looks like a bribe to ease regulations on the merger," says Daniel Garner, a partner with the sports, entertainment, and fashion law firm Daniel Ebling, Masha, and Cohen. That said, she adds, Paramount is a private company, which means it's not bound by the First Amendment the same way a public entity would be, and is perfectly capable of changing its editorial direction at will. A spokesperson from the New York Attorney General's office confirmed to Vanity Fair that it is monitoring the situation. But in order to prove bribery, a hypothetical investigation would need to find proof of a quid pro quo between Paramount and the Trump administration. Garneau is less than optimistic that such evidence exists. "I don't think that there would be anything in writing or documentation," she tells Vanity Fair. "I'd be very, very surprised if there was." Still, Hines believes it's worth at least trying to uncover any information that could suggest that the cancellation was part of a deal. After all, she tells Vanity Fair, this administration and their donors and the companies that have capitulated to them have done nothing to earn public trust. Even in the absence of evidence that proves a deal, Hines said, I just think when something like that, like this happens that looks so bad, it is important to have a reaction. The second Late Night Insider agrees that the late show's cancellation opens a dangerous door. Now, if you're Disney and you know that you have a merger or an affiliate change or any kind of business thing coming up, you know that one thing you can offer him is Jimmy Kimmel going out the door. It's now a thing that can be sacrificed to curry his favor. As Trump celebrates the end of The Late Show and threatens other programs like The View, the Late Night Insider warns that this could be just the beginning. The floodgates are open. Any series featuring content the president doesn't like could be a target. As long as you keep giving in, they will keep taking. Which is why comedy writers don't plan to back down, they say. The bottom line? We have to go down fighting. Another current event we're talking about this week, Sydney Sweeney under fire after controversial American Eagle ad campaign. Sweeney's Great Jeans ad was intended to celebrate the clothing company's flattering cuts. Now critics have accused her and American Eagle of flirting with eugenic imagery. This is by Elia Germinal-Bauer on August 1st. Update, Friday, August 1st. Days after the controversy began, American Eagle has released a statement about it on Instagram. The campaign, the company writes, is and always was about the jeans, her story. We'll continue to celebrate how everyone wears their American Eagle jeans with confidence, their way. Great jeans look good on everyone, and that's jeans with a J. Does Sydney Sweeney have great jeans, or has the American Eagle brand simply had a very, very bad idea? The label's latest advertising campaign has been setting social networks ablaze, and not just because it features the Euphoria actor in a tight tank top. Called Sydney Sweeney Has Great Jeans, it's based around a play on words that may seem harmless, but has been criticized by onlookers who see a sinister message lurking beneath the pun. One ad from the autumn campaign shows Sweeney leaning over the engine of her Ford Mustang. She slams the hood and wipes her hands on the back of her jeans, not without a close-up from the cameraman, before settling behind the wheel and disappearing. A second begins with Sweeney speaking about her jeans as the camera slowly pans down to her cleavage, before she reprimands it with a smiling, "Hey, eyes up here." The series' most criticized ad shows the actor reclining on a couch as she squirms while fastening her pants and murmuring, "Jeans," that is G-E-N-E-S, are passed down from parents to offspring, often determining traits like hair color, personality, and even eye color. "My jeans are blue." Then a male narrator concludes, "Sydney Sweeney has great jeans." A few of the videos have been removed from the brand's official accounts, but even so, some internet users see a message as clear as a billboard in Times Square, where the campaign was actually posted, believing that the ads seem to glorify a particular racial ideal. On TikTok, videos racking up hundreds of thousands of views have accused the brand of sending out a eugenicist dog whistle by focusing on a white, blonde, blue-eyed woman who talks about jeans. Other users have slammed the videos for being regressive and degrading to women. Creative that borrows from the male gaze is not always met with unanimous approval, as was the case with singer Sabrina Carpenter's cover for her forthcoming album, Man's Best Friend, which also sparked much debate on social networks. Neither Sweeney nor American Eagle has addressed the controversy publicly as of Tuesday morning. Vanity Fair has reached out to representatives for both for comment. The most talked about videos echo an infamous 1980 Calvin Klein campaign shot by Richard Avedon. Avedon's most famous commercial featured Brooke Shields, then age 15, whispering to the camera as she unbuttoned her jeans, "You know what comes between me and my Calvins? Nothing." The ad came under fire for sexualizing a child, and though Sweeney is 26, her campaign, clearly inspired by Shields, is at the heart of a similar scandal. While the criticism was flying, sales were taking off. Shortly after the campaign announcement, American Eagle's stock jumped 10%, adding about $200 million to the group's value, a godsend for a brand that had a disastrous year on the stock market. For some, the campaign has even been seen as an anti-woke triumph. Right-wing pundit Richard Hanania, who declared wokeness dead in the wee hours of March 3, 2024, right after Sweeney hosted Saturday Night Live while wearing a selection of low-cut outfits, and then published an essay in his newsletter titled, "Yes, Sydney Sweeney's Boobs Are Anti-Woke," congratulated himself on the ad campaign's existence. And this isn't the first time Sweeney has been unwillingly associated with political debates. In 2022, she posted a photo from her mother's birthday party that showed a guest wearing a MAGA hat, sparking rumors about her own political opinions. She responded to them with incredulity. "An innocent celebration for my mom's milestone 60th birthday has turned into an absurd political statement, which was not the intention," she posted at the time. "Please stop making assumptions. Much love to everyone." Ironically, a campaign that's been accused of promoting backward-looking ideas actually has a charitable dimension. American Eagle's Sydney jeans sport a butterfly on their back pocket, according to the company's website. The design represents domestic violence awareness, which Sydney is passionate about. All proceeds from those jeans, American Eagle says, will be donated to the Crisis Text Line, a nonprofit offering free 24/7 confidential mental health support to anyone in need. But it's difficult to make this message heard amid the ambient noise. The controversy comes from the latest risky advertising partnership signed by the White Lotus actor, who most recently sold a soap for men infused with her own bathwater. In this campaign, Sweeney may have had very good genes, but clearly when it comes to communication, the subtle gene has skipped a generation. In a little Hollywood gossip, Tom Cruise and Ana de Armas are photographed hand in hand. The two actors strolled while holding hands in Woodstock, Vermont, a first public gesture of affection after months of gossip about their relationship. This is by Roberta Mercury on July 30th. For months, onlookers have been whispering about Tom Cruise, 63, and Ana de Armas, 37, claiming the two are a couple. Now photos have arrived that seem to confirm the alleged relationship. After attending an Oasis concert at London's Wembley Stadium, the two actors returned to the United States, heading to Woodstock, a town of 3,000 souls in wooded Vermont. They probably did not expect to run into paparazzi there, but TMZ still managed to capture them between shopping sessions and ice cream as they strolled around holding hands. TMZ reports that during the weekend in Woodstock, the two also indulged in a drive-through a national park. In short, they certainly appear to be a couple. Cruise and de Armas met on the set of the film Deeper and have been stoking gossip for 6 months. It all started last February when they were photographed having dinner in a London restaurant. Since then, they've been spotted together around the world, taking all means of transportation, cabs, boats, private planes. They've attended concerts and various events together, including the London party for David Beckham's 50th birthday. Until now, however, they never had indulged in a public gesture of affection. Far from the bright lights of Hollywood, we now have the first photos that seem to confirm the liaison. Cruise has been publicly single since as far back as 2012, the year of his divorce from Katie Holmes, mother of his daughter, Suri. Cruise has two other children, Isabella and Connor, whom he shares with his first wife, Nicole Kidman, their marriage ending in 2001. De Armas had a much-talked-about affair with Ben Affleck a few years ago. Until recently, she was romantically linked to Manuel Anito Cuesta, stepson of Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel. According to rumors, her breakup with Cuesta would have occurred around the same time as her growing closeness with Cruise. When pressed by the media on her relationship with Cruise, De Armas has limited herself to professional comments. In May, she told Good Morning America that she was working on several projects with Doug Liman, Christopher McQuarrie, and of course Tom, and I'm so excited. It was not exactly a sentimental declaration. One wonders if either her or Cruise will be more open now that these photos have appeared. Reps for both actors have not responded to a request for comment. Next up, we have a review. Liam Neeson and Pamela Anderson make beautifully dumb music in The Naked Gun. At its best, this reboot of the beloved comedy franchise is a blissfully stupid delight. This is by Richard Lawson on July 30th. "A strange thing happened to me in a movie theater the other day. I was sitting there in the dark, watching actors say and do things, when all of a sudden I laughed out loud. And then I did it again. And again. Not the kind of gentle, amused chuckle elicited by a short guy joke in The Materialists or a clever Superman quip. Big, unrestrained laughter, the kind that's so hard to come by at the movies these days. The last time I felt this sensation wasn't at the cinema at all. It was watching the delightful play, Oh Mary, last year. How rare and how truly special. That is the great gift of director and co-writer Akiva Schaffer's The Naked Gun on August 1st, a continuation of the beloved 1980s and 90s police spoof film series. At its best, this new Naked Gun is a dumb, loopy delight, a return to the kind of comedy that was woefully taken for granted in its heyday and now barely exists at all. What happened to comedy? On TV, the multi-camera sitcom largely died. Single-camera, half-hour shows started paring down the jokes, and people began seeking stuff to laugh at on the vertical rectangles of their phones. At the movies, standalone comedies became harder to sell. They don't tend to perform well internationally, unlike IP action spectaculars. I've woefully participated in that evolution, or devolution. Wanting to keep the good guy feeling going after my Naked Gun screening, I went home and watched videos of dogs falling into swimming pools and cats doing accidental yoga poses. Dogs Being Idiots is a regularly recommended video title on my YouTube feed. America's Funniest Home Videos have become, by some measure, our chief source of comedy, with the occasional stand-up special or whatever else interrupting our short-form squirrels. Enter The Naked Gun, the new film starring Liam Neeson as the doltish son of the late great Leslie Nielsen's LAPD detective Frank Drebin. They share the same name. Arrives as a wonderful anomaly as a scant few other laugh-out-loud comedies like One of Them Days have in recent years. The first 20 or so minutes of Schaffer's film are a rapid-fire lark, filled with awful, and thus good, puns, dopey misunderstandings, sight gags so corny they're brilliant, and some genuinely sly satire about what one might call copaganda. Though any analysis of this movie really shouldn't introduce such heavy terms. I don't want to butcher any of the movie's gassy jokes by repeating them here. The greatest of them, though, rival the brilliance of the 1988 original. That masterpiece, yes, still prevails in any comparison, but the new version does much to honor its notable predecessor. At least for those first 20 minutes or so, this Naked Gun loses steam as it goes, perhaps becoming a bit too concerned with its plot. Danny Houston plays a tech industrialist with an evil plan to fix human civilization, and letting the antic joke conveyor belt slow in the process. There is also some mission creep away from the house style and toward Schaffer's particular brand of humor, honed with his comedy group The Lonely Island on Saturday Night Live and beyond. Lonely Island stuff is plenty absurdist, but it has a more iconic, self-consciously weird edge than benefits the Naked Gun movie. Still, the movie earns hefty guffaws to the end, its goodwill intact. Neeson, who is paying respectful homage to Nielsen's sterling work while also satirizing the tough guy career he's built for himself since Taken, never betrays a hint of embarrassment or discomfort in being asked to do the dumbest of things. He is game and limber, even if one does see his stern face and yearn for Nielsen's more elastic mugging. Perhaps Neeson can show the way for other actors looking to do big screen comedy. Come on in, the water's fine, and way more fun than doing another streaming murder show. Every noir detective needs his mysterious vamp, and thus the Naked Gun has brought in Pamela Anderson to play Beth Davenport, the glamorous sister of a murder victim, and of course a sultry love interest for Frank. Anderson, with her breathy voice and bombshell past, is shrewdly cast here and seizes the opportunity to tweak her erstwhile image. She and Neeson merrily stage the film's crudest jokes, two actors from wholly different avenues of their profession finding zany harmony at the strangest of intersections. Their casting is sharp enough to feel inevitable, but who else but Neeson and Anderson could have picked up where Nielsen and Priscilla Presley left off? Schaffer seems to have had the proper perspective on this reboot from its inception. That he loses his way here and there might merely be a sign that this particular comedy engine was always going to rattle a bit as it turned back on after so many years of neglect. Here's hoping it starts purring smoothly soon enough. In the meantime, if The Naked Gun has stoked a hunger for more entertainment like it, you should seek out some of its small screen brethren, like the riotous and unjustly short-lived 2020 Netflix series Medical Police, from the children's hospital term. How nice it is to laugh like an idiot and not have to open Reels or TikTok to do it. Our next headline, Let's Dance. Misty Copeland, Tyler Mitchell, Antoine Sargent, and more celebrate the power of dance and community. Now in its fifth year, the Band Together Dance Festival at Lincoln Center aims to make dance accessible to a new generation, all with support from Chanel. This is by Daniela Tijerina on July 31st. On Tuesday night, as a blistering heat wave swept across New York City, Chanel Fashion, an elegant evening at Tatiana by Kwame Onwuachi in Lincoln Center, where artists across disciplines gathered to celebrate the fifth anniversary of the Band Together Dance Festival. As part of Lincoln Center's Summer for the City programming, the festival fosters a rare collaboration between five esteemed dance companies: Ballet Hispanico, Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater, American Ballet Theater, New York City Ballet, and Dance Theater of Harlem, bringing them all together with pay-as-you-wish ticketing on one stage for five nights. Each company speaks a different language, Misty Copeland, American Ballet principal dancer, tells Vanity Fair. To see them come together and represent their language and their community so beautifully. But yet, we're all speaking the same language of dance. This is what dance should be doing. It's unifying. It should bring communities together. It doesn't matter what genre of dance. I get emotional every time I see one of the band festival shows. From Copeland to Thelma Golden, director of the Studio Museum in Harlem, photographer Tyler Mitchell, Antoine Sargent, the director at Gagosian, Sade Lifcott, CEO of the National Black Theater, and Barbara Pierce Bush, now NBA's Vice President of Social Impact. Guests found respite from the heat while sipping on spicy margaritas, chilled rosé, and vibrant floral jello shots before packing the sold-out David K. H. Koch Theater on the festival's opening night. Back in 2021, as the world began slowly to open back up after the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, the Band Together Dance Festival originated in partnership with Chanel, who has a long-standing patronage in the world of dance, as a seed of hope for the dance community and an opportunity for New Yorkers to gather once again. The aim was not only to celebrate the arts during a time of uncertainty, but to offer dance as something both accessible and healing. It was about the audience, and it was also about the dancers, about the future of dance, and really believing that we were stronger together, says Sean Tathaki, Chief Artistic Director of Lincoln Center. The fact that these companies can be humble enough to share the stage with one another, and you can see it in the dancers watching from the wings, you could see it in the artistic directors talking to one another, it's just this feeling of unending possibility and of growth, says Tathaki. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is the Vanity Fair Hour, and my name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We are in the middle of an article about the Band Together dance performance at the Lincoln Center. Throughout the evening, each company brought a distinct point of view to the stage, from traditional moving ballet duets to thrilling boundary-pushing group numbers, all unified by their shared celebration of collaboration. Looking out onto the crowd, the joy was palpable as it spread through the room and spilled out onto the steps of Lincoln Center, currently adorned with a massive disco ball because that night there was truly something for everyone at the theater. It means the world to me because I fought my whole career to get a diverse audience in the Metropolitan Opera House when I'm performing, says Copeland. To see Lincoln Center really hold on to that messaging, even if I'm not on the stage, that's something that really remains a priority. This year, the festival is expanding their reach beyond the theater to offer dance workshops curated by each company to all ages and abilities, bringing the joy of dancing together off the stage and onto the streets of New York City. This is what it's all for. This is the best part of it, says Copeland, because they're really following through with what it is they're trying to do. It's not just getting people who can afford it in the theater, but reaching out to the next generation, giving them access and opportunity. We are moving to the politics section now. Our first headline, Senate confirms Jeanine Pirro as U.S. Attorney for D.C., cementing decades-long friendship with Trump. The former Fox News host was nominated after the president withdrew his first choice, right-wing podcaster Ed Martin. This is by Katie Hirschenroder on August 3rd. Former Fox News host Jeanine Pirro was confirmed as the U.S. Attorney for Washington, D.C. on Saturday, a crescendo in her and President Donald Trump's decades-long friendship. Their friendship has included Trump donating to her once active aspirations to run for office, pardoning her ex-husband, and advocating for her show to remain on Fox, and Pirro writing a fawning book about him, echoing his big lie about the 2020 election and serving as a mouthpiece for his current anti-immigration campaign. Pirro has been serving as interim U.S. attorney since May. On Saturday, the Senate voted 50-45 to formalize her role, with all the Democrats present opposing her confirmation. Despite their mutual support, Pirro was Trump's second choice for the role. The president originally opted for interim U.S. Attorney Ed Martin, but removed his support after the longtime right-wing activist faced opposition from Senator Tom Tillis, a Republican from North Carolina who serves on the Senate Judiciary Committee due to Martin's close connections to the January 6th insurrection. As NBC News reported in May, Martin had been serving as the interim attorney for Washington since Inauguration Day, and during his time oversaw the firings of January 6th prosecutors and demoted others, and opened an investigation into the office's handling of the Capitol riot investigation. Once Martin lost the gig, Trump named Pirro, a former New York State District Attorney and county judge, to the post. Pirro joins other Fox News alums who have made their way further into Trump's Washington. According to a May roundup from Newsweek, Pirro is the 23rd current or former Fox News employee Trump has recruited for his administration since taking office earlier this year. This group includes, among others, Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth, Deputy Director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation Dan Bongino, Secretary of Transportation Sean Duffy, Ambassador to Israel Mike Huckabee, and Border Czar Tom Homan. Pirro and Trump's friendship began over three decades ago when Trump hired her ex-husband, Al Pirro, to be a real estate lawyer. As Kenzie Bryant reported for Vanity Fair, they were in the same party circuit in New York and both had political ambitions. In 2005, Pirro sought the GOP Senate nomination to race against Hillary Clinton, a campaign that Trump, according to the New York Daily News, donated to. Pirro would eventually drop out of that race to become the Republican nominee for New York Attorney General in 2006, a race she lost to Andrew Cuomo, and who would go on to be the state's governor before resigning in disgrace and launching a New York City mayoral bid. After her stint running for office, Pirro had a Judge Judy-esque daytime TV show on the CW, which was canceled in 2011. That's when Pirro made her way to Fox, a role that she held during Trump's first run for office almost a decade ago. She lauded Trump on TV, verbally eviscerated his perceived enemies, and, as Bryant wrote, torpedoed any previous bipartisan respect. In 2018, Pirro penned the book Liars, Leakers, and Liberals, The Case Against the Anti-Trump Conspiracy. The Washington Post, in a review of six pro-Trump texts, called Pirro's work the most gushing. In it, she railed against fake news, crooked Hillary, liar Obama, and liberal haters, while celebrating Trump's kryptonite-proof aura of invincibility. When Trump ran again and lost in the 2020 cycle, Pirro was a vocal supporter of his unsubstantiated big lie that the election was stolen from him. She was later cited in a defamation lawsuit against Fox News by Dominion Voting Systems for her role in spreading this disinformation. In December 2023, Fox reached a $787.5 million settlement with Dominion and was forced to acknowledge that Pirro, along with others at Fox, had peddled false claims about Dominion. The support came the other way, too, from Trump to Pirro. In March of 2019, Pirro sparked outrage on her Fox show, Justice with Judge Jeanine, when she questioned if Representative Ilhan Omar of Minnesota could be loyal to the United States because she wore a hijab. Is her adherence to this Islamic doctrine indicative of her adherence to Sharia law? Pirro asked her audience, which in itself is antithetical to the United States Constitution. Fox News distanced itself from the remarks, but Pirro didn't. The following week, her show didn't air at its regular Saturday night slot. "Bring back Judge Jeanine Pirro," Trump wrote in a post on then Twitter. "The radical left Democrats, working closely with their beloved partner, the fake news media, is using every trick in the book to silence a majority of our country. They have all-out campaigns against Fox News hosts who are doing well." In the beginning of 2021, as he was less than an hour away from leaving the White House, Trump announced he was pardoning Pirro's ex-husband, who in 2000 was convicted at a trial in New York federal court of conspiracy and tax evasion in connection with illegally deducting $1.2 million of personal expenses as write-offs for his business, according to CNBC. On Saturday, Senator Chuck Grassley, a Republican from Iowa and the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, celebrated Pirro's confirmation. "You may hear my Democrat colleagues criticize Ms. Pirro for some of her colorful remarks during her time as a TV personality," he said, acknowledging that, yes, she has a larger-than-life personality. Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois, the top Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, was quick to denounce his Republican colleague's decision, calling Pirro's record deeply troubling. "President Trump has been using the Justice Department to protect his allies and go after his enemies, and Ms. Pirro has proven to be a willing accomplice in weaponizing the justice system," he said in a statement. "She is not fit to be the U.S. attorney for our nation's capital, and I believe it's a grave mistake my Republican colleagues voted to confirm her." Our next headline in the politics section: Trump fires U.S. labor official claiming she rigged lackluster jobs report. This is by Katie Hirschenroder on August 2nd. It only took a few hours for President Donald Trump to call for the firing of a top Bureau of Labor Statistics official after a weaker-than-expected jobs report called into question the strength of his administration's economic policies. Early Friday, the Labor Department released a report finding that the economy added 73,000 jobs last month, a number that was lower than anticipated. The employment rate also rose by 0.1 percentage point from the previous month, from 4.1% to 4.2%, and job gains from the last 2 months were revised by a total of 258,000. While revisions to prior months' numbers are normal, this high of a decrease came as a surprise. Trump's fury over the somber jobs report fell squarely on Erica McIntyre, the commissioner of BLS. Hours after the latest stats were released, the president, in a long-winded Truth Social post filled with evidenceless claims of a coordinated conspiracy against him, called for Dr. McIntyre's firing. Appointed by President Joe Biden, McIntyre was confirmed to the role by the Senate on a bipartisan basis in 2024. She handily won that vote with 86 in favor and only 8 opposed. Now Vice President J.D. Vance was among the yay votes. In the post, Trump accused McIntyre of being incompetent and of faking the numbers for political purposes. "I have directed my team to fire this Biden political appointee immediately," the president wrote on his social media platform. "She will be replaced with someone much more competent and qualified." An hour later, Lori Chavez de Remer, the labor secretary, echoed Trump on X, saying, "I support the president's decision." While the department searches for a replacement, she wrote, "Deputy Commissioner William Wiatrowski will serve as acting commissioner." "Thanks to President Trump, our economy is booming," Secretary Chavez de Remer wrote, departing from the BLS report. "And with the help of fair trade deals and the One Big Beautiful Bill, American workers will prosper." Later on Friday, Trump took a victory lap, telling reporters he did the right thing. As the New York Times reports, Trump and his top aides have made a habit of attacking government agencies, researchers, and watchdogs when they've produced findings that the president does not like. This recurring cycle, the Times' Ben Castleman and Tony Rahm wrote Friday, has led to concerns that Mr. Trump could seek to interfere with the operations of the BLS and other statistical agencies, particularly if the economy begins to take a turn for the worse. McIntyre was not immediately available to comment to the Times. The move drew swift and intense backlash from William Beach, who led the Bureau during Trump's first term. This could set a precedent where bad news on many different fronts is a reason for dismissing a person, he said in the Times. Beach also served under Biden and said he never felt pressure to manipulate the data under either president, adding that even if there were pressure, there is no way the commissioner could interfere in the revisions process, a process, he explained, that is conducted by career employees. Whether or not the Trump administration confirms the latest BLS data, Americans are still feeling a strain on their wallet. According to the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority's Investor Education Foundation's new National Financial Capability Study, there's been a 10 percentage point decrease over the past 3 years in the number of adults saying that they find it easy to cover their expenses and pay their bills. And in a recent poll conducted by Morning Consult for the Century Foundation, 6 out of 10 Americans hold the Trump administration responsible for driving up their cost of living. The poll asked 2,007 Americans how they're managing the high cost of living in the U.S. economy, who they think is to blame, and what the solutions are. In Trump's attack on the recent data release, he paid particular attention to the 258,000 jobs that were removed from previous job reports. But revision, in and of itself, is a normal part of releasing data on employment, as the department continues to incorporate data that wasn't initially available or to reflect information from more authoritative sources. Trump's tone about jobs data and shifting numbers depends greatly on how the reporting makes his administration's policies look. The Associated Press on Friday pointed out this pattern, noting that during his 2016 campaign, he often attacked the jobs figures as they showed the unemployment rate steadily declining while Barack Obama was still president, only to immediately switch to praising the data once he was in office as steady job gains continued. High-profile Democrats were also quick to denounce the move. What does a bad leader do when they get bad news? Democratic Senator Leader Chuck Schumer of New York asked in a Friday speech. Shoot the messenger. Instead of helping people get good jobs, Donald Trump just fired the statistician who reported bad jobs data and the wannabe king doesn't like. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren wrote on X. Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, who is the ranking member on the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee that oversees the Labor Department, decried the decision on X. This is what authoritarians do. That a Senate-approved bipartisan official could be out of a job hours after doing something that reflected poorly on the current administration raises concerns that Americans may not receive accurate information should that data diverge from what powerful people in Washington want to represent. This concern could lead to a crisis of trust amongst people across the nation, according to economic experts. If you want people to stop trusting the numbers coming out of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, Martha Gimbel, the executive director of the Budget Lab at Yale, who served in the White House under Biden, began, firing the person who is confirmed by the Senate to make sure those numbers are trustworthy is a real good way to do it. We're moving now to the first of our Best Levin reports. This first headline, 2 more Trump administration officials are gone after complaints from Laura Loomer. The right-wing influencer appears to be exercising major influence on administration personnel. This is by Best Levin on July 30th. Back in April, Donald Trump fired a trio of national security officials after meeting with far-right activist Laura Loomer, who reportedly complained to the president about the individual's alleged disloyalty and urged him to cut them loose. And now it appears she's done it again. Trump denied that Loomer recommended the terminations, though he acknowledged she suggested some people for the jobs. April Falcon Doss, a lawyer for the National Security Agency, was removed from her position last week after Loomer amplified criticism of her, according to an official familiar with the matter who spoke to the New York Times. Loomer had shared a social media post about Doss that described her as a far-left Democrat activist and claimed that she advocated for the debanking and online censorship of conservatives. In a text message to the Times, Loomer appeared to take credit for Doss's firing, telling the outlet that she had reposted a tweet that exposed her last week and flagged it for the right people. Doss, who worked for the NSA prior to becoming the general counsel and is an expert in cybersecurity law, did not respond to a request for comment from the Times. The Pentagon did not immediately respond to the Times request for comment. In a statement, Senator Mark Warner, who sits on the Senate Intelligence Committee, called Doss a deeply principled public servant and said her dismissal appears to be the result of a politically motivated smear campaign driven by a far-right conspiracy theorist, not any legitimate concern about her conduct or qualifications. Doss's firing comes several months after NSA Director General Timothy Hall and his deputy Wendy Noble were removed from their positions following complaints from Loomer that they were allegedly disloyal to Trump. At the time, The Times reported that Noble was potentially reassigned to another position at the Pentagon, though it's not clear if that happened. Meanwhile, on Wednesday, Dr. Vinay Prasad announced that he was stepping down as the Food and Drug Administration's vaccine chief, saying via a spokesperson that he did not want to be a distraction and was leaving to spend more time with his family. While Prasad's short tenure on the job was controversial from the start, given his years as a vocal FDA critic, the Associated Press notes that in recent weeks, Prasad became a target of right-wing activists, including Laura Loomer, who flagged Prasad's past statements criticizing Trump and praising liberal independent Senator Bernie Sanders. In a post on X last week, Loomer wrote, "How did this Trump-hating Bernie bro get into the Trump admin?" And a Times profile earlier this month on Trump's blunt instrument chronicled Loomer's clout in the White House and also included critics on the right, such as Tucker Carlson, who's also been on the receiving end of her social media attacks. "She is like a child wielding a loaded firearm called Twitter," Carlson said. "I don't blame her. I blame the adults who take her seriously." Our next headline, Pete Hegseth is reportedly thinking about taking his talents to the Tennessee governor's mansion. The Defense Department, meanwhile, insists the ex-Fox News host isn't going anywhere. This is on July 30th. Once upon a time, being involved in the number of scandals Pete Hegseth has been a part of during his 6 months as defense secretary would have resulted in a swift firing or a resignation, accompanied by a statement about deep regrets. Of course, in 2025, things are a little different. A person can now not only survive more than one incident involving classified military plans being texted to civilians, but also apparently take stock of the situation and think, "I'm doing a great job here, and the American people want more of me." NBC News reports that Hegseth, according to two people who have directly talked about the matter with him, has privately discussed the idea of running for political office next year in Tennessee. One of those people told the outlet that their conversation with the Fox News host turned cabinet secretary occurred in the last 3 weeks and that it was serious, not simply spitballing ideas. Presumably, spitballing conversations with Hegseth are reserved for matters like, "Should I make a TikTok about bombing Yemen?" The other individual, who reportedly also characterized their conversation as serious, would not say exactly when they had spoken to the secretary, only sharing that it was after he was installed at the Department of Defense. According to NBC, the discussions were focused on the specifics of running, including eligibility requirements for a Tennessee gubernatorial run and Hegseth's shot at winning. Both people said Hegseth has mentioned a potential campaign for the Tennessee governorship. The two sources came away from their conversations unsure if the defense secretary would actually go for it. In a statement, a spokesperson for the Pentagon told NBC, "Fake news NBC is so desperate for attention, they are shopping around a made-up story again. Only two options exist. Either the sources are imaginary or these reporters are getting punked." Secretary Hegseth's focus remains solely on serving under President Trump and advancing the America First mission at the Department of Defense. Speaking to Politico, allies of Hegseth recently voiced worries that a laundry list of scandals could lead to his downfall, with one person describing his leadership as the creme de la creme of dysfunction. Adding to a list of reported controversies that includes not one, but two Signalgate scandals, the Washington Post recently wrote that the White House had to order Hegseth to stop subjecting Defense Department staffers to lie detector tests. In a statement, a Pentagon spokesperson told the Post, "The department will not comment on an ongoing investigation. The fake news media's obsession with months-old workplace gossip is a reflection of the sad and pathetic state of journalism in Washington." Yet, Hegseth reportedly remains in Trump's good graces. As one Trump ally put it to Politico, "The boss loves him, so it's like, we'll make it work." Tennessee Republican Party Chairman Scott Golden told NBC that he had not discussed a potential Hegseth run with Trump, saying, "Nobody is called to talk about this as a reality. I don't know where it's coming from, and maybe it will be real." Our next Levin report, Trump accuses Epstein of taking people from his Mar-a-Lago spa and suggests one woman Epstein stole was Virginia Jeffrey. This is on July 29th. One of the obvious reasons that the Jeffrey Epstein saga has so spectacularly blown up in Donald Trump's face is that so many members of the administration, including the president himself, spent years hyping the idea that the government was involved in a vast cover-up of both the disgraced financier's crimes and those of his powerful associates, the details of which Trump was going to blow the doors wide open. So when the Trump administration announced earlier this month that there were actually no further details to share and that no one else was going to be charged, the very people Team Trump had spent years riling up were pretty pissed. Another reason this whole thing won't go away? Probably the fact that the president can't stop offering bizarre commentary on the matter, like talking about how he declined the privilege of going to the private island where Epstein committed many of his horrific crimes, leaving the door wide open to pardoning convicted Epstein associate Ghislaine Maxwell, and casually claiming that Epstein took one of his victims from the spa at Mar-a-Lago. Speaking on board Air Force One on Tuesday, the president was asked about a remark he'd made the day prior about ending his friendship with Epstein because he stole people that worked for him. "Were some of the workers that were taken from you, were some of them young women?" a reporter asked, to which Trump responded, "I don't want to say, but everyone knows the people that were taken. The concept of taking people that work for me is bad, and the answer is yes, they were. I have a great spa, one of the best spas in the world at Mar-a-Lago," he continued, "and people were taken out of the spa, hired by him, in other words, gone." Asked by another reporter if one of those stolen persons included Virginia Jeffrey, one of Epstein's most prominent victims, Trump answered, "I don't know. I think she worked at the spa. I think so. That was one of the people. He stole her. And by the way, she had no complaints about us, none whatsoever." The president's explosive remarks follow him talking Monday about the prospect of pardoning Maxwell. "Well, I'm allowed to give her a pardon, but nobody's approached me with it. Nobody's asked me about it. It's in the news about that, the aspect of it, but right now it would be inappropriate to talk about it." That was the second time in a matter of days that Trump emphasized that he has the power to pardon the longtime Epstein associate who is currently serving a 20-year prison sentence. For her part, Maxwell has asked the Supreme Court to overturn her convictions. She also wants immunity in exchange for testifying before Congress, having been subpoenaed to appear next month. Also on Monday, Trump denied ever visiting Epstein's Caribbean island with a characteristically bizarre turn of phrase, saying, "I never had the privilege of going to his island, and I did turn it down, but a lot of people in Palm Beach were invited to his island. In one of my very good moments, I turned it down. I didn't want to go to his island." And then explained why he apparently ended his friendship with Epstein. "I wouldn't talk to Jeffrey Epstein because he did something that was inappropriate," the president said. "He stole people that worked for me. I said, don't ever do that again. He did it again, and I threw him out of that place," he said, referring to Mar-a-Lago. And of course, it wouldn't have been a Trump presser without claims of a hoax and a shot at his Democratic foes. Responding to a question about whether Attorney General Pam Bondi had told him his name was mentioned in the Epstein files, the president said he hasn't been overly interested in it because it's a hoax that's been built up way beyond proportion. Then he suggested Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, James Comey, and Merrick Garland, all recurring MAGA targets, planted evidence about him in the documents. I can say this, he said. Those files were run by the worst scum on earth. They were run by Comey. They were run by Garland. They were run by Biden and all the other people that actually ran the government, including the auto pen. Those files were run for 4 years by those people. If they had anything on Trump, I assume they would have released it. And our last Levin report, Jamie Dimon says, we'll see, on Mamdani as fellow finance titans lose their minds. Earlier this month, the JP Morgan CEO called Mamdani a Marxist and lashed out at the Democrats for supporting the candidate's proposed policies. This is on July 31st. After Zohran Mamdani won the Democratic primary for mayor, a number of billionaires and some mere millionaires began sounding the alarm at the possibility of a self-described Democratic socialist running New York City. Hedge fund manager Daniel Loeb invoked Fidel Castro. Venture capitalist David Sachs warned people to get on board with MAGA or prepare to be on Mamdani's dinner menu. Hedge fund manager Bill Ackman claimed that Mamdani's policies would be disastrous for NYC and called on a charismatic, intelligent, articulate, handsome, charming, young, yet more experienced politician to take on the Democratic nominee. JP Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon branded Mamdani a Marxist and criticized Democrats for falling all over themselves to support his policies, which he called ideological mush that means nothing in the real world. And while it seems unlikely that Dimon is going to start showing up to campaign events with Mamdani and urging New Yorkers to cast a vote for the guy, he does appear to have moderated his opinion on the candidate, if only slightly. Speaking to CNBC on Thursday, the banking chief repeated his position, claiming that a lot of the things Mamdani prescribes have never worked before, but adding, we'll see. And then he said that if Mamdani were to win the general election in November, he would still try and help him do the best job he can. Dimon's comments were more than a little toned down compared to the ones he made earlier this month, wherein he said, I have a lot of friends who are Democrats, and they're idiots, adding, I always say they have big hearts and little brains. They do not understand how the real world works. Almost every single policy rolled out failed. As for his fellow finance titans, their concerns about Mamdani presumably have to do with the candidate's proposals to raise New York's top corporate tax rate from 7.2% to 11.5% and levy a 2% tax on individuals earning more than $1 million a year. Changes that his campaign said would raise $9 billion in tax revenue. But Mamdani would need Governor Kathy Hochul to get on board with these moves, and she's already shot them down. And since winning the primary, he said that while he doesn't think billionaires should exist, he wants to work with everyone, including billionaires. As Catherine Wild, president and CEO of the Partnership for New York City, told Vanity Fair's Chris Smith earlier this month, Mamdani called me shortly after the primary and said, I want to thank you because you were willing to meet with me when I was polling at 1%. He's calling up everybody I ask him to call, saying he wants to work together, giving him his cell number. Jamie Dimon famously said that during 8 years as mayor, Bill de Blasio never called him. He's doing a lot more than Bill ever did. Earlier this month, former Governor Andrew Cuomo, who resoundingly lost to Mamdani in the primary, announced that he would run as an independent in the general election, as will current Mayor Eric Adams. A new poll released this week shows Mamdani beating both of them by double digits. This brings us to the end of our time together here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, my name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thank you so much for tuning in. I invite you to join me next week for another full hour of stories from vanityfair.com. Thanks again for listening and have a great week, everybody.